Anchor.fm.
Mm-hmm.
Man, move over and let me pass. Before they have to be pulling these hush puppies out your...
Whoa! What Dolomite is trying to say is, you are listening to the only station making waves, WHFR.fm.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. Where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Now, a few people haven't heard of the 1947 Roswell UFO crash. However, most folks outside the UFO community are unaware of the fact that there was a second UFO crash further north in New Mexico at the same time. Now, Art Campbell has spent several years excavating the site at this alleged crash, and lots of his own money having the material he has unearthed, scientifically analyzed, and peer-reviewed. He has shared his findings in his book, Finding the UFO Crash at St. Augustine. Isotopic metal analysis, not of this earth. So Art Campbell served during the Korean War aboard the aircraft carrier USS Boxer with a fleet electronics training unit. And he is a retired educator, teacher, coach, and former principal and counselor. He has been active in UFO investigations since the mid-1950s. And started a NICAP affiliate in Kansas City, Missouri, working closely with NICAP's Donald E. Kehoe. And we're fortunate to have Ms. Campbell on the line with us today to share some of those findings with us. So welcome to the show, Art.
Well, it's glad to be here, Dave. I've been looking forward to being on.
Well, we've been looking forward to having you. I read your book. It was very detailed, quite detailed, in fact. So enjoyed it a lot, and so let's discuss it. Now, Stanton Friedman wrote a book called Crash at Corona, and that was allegedly the second UFO crash at Roswell at the time. Is the San Augustine crash one and the same?
Well, originally, Dave, they thought it might be, and we had some people that were kind of rallying around the flag at Roswell, and they were kind of threatened by anything else that happened anywhere else. And we're pretty sure it was a separate craft, and it was about 160 miles west of Roswell. Okay. And Friedman was writing about the impact site north of Roswell. They said the craft came down there, and Marcel found and Braswell found debris, but no craft. And I think Friedman is writing about the crash, the actual craft they found, 4 or 5 miles north of that debris site. We're 165 miles due west of there at a place called the Plains of San Augustine.
Okay.
It's an old dry lake bed.
Okay. So it makes it sound like there were actually three incidences.
I think you could say that. Yes.
Okay, so there was the Roswell crash, which was really not in Roswell, but near Roswell, and 100 miles north of Roswell is Corona, and then what did you say? 160 miles west of Corona is St. Augustine.
Actually, St. Augustine is due west of Roswell. So Corona is the nearest town to the site of the second of where the Roswell crash came down.
All right.
We have only rumors about it, no wreckage or anything, but we have complete wreckage of everything, probably 15, 20 pounds of wreckage we found over in the last 5 or 6 years at on the plains of St. Augustine.
Okay, so long story short, was there two crashes, two craft, or three craft?
Well, I know of two. The Roswell craft dropped some material and then crashed later. So the debris field was not a crash site. There was no crash there, but there was a lot of debris left there. And so then they found it later. It was brought into town at Roswell about the 5th or 6th. Ours went down on the night of the 2nd, the 1st or 2nd of 1947. So essentially the one we're working was went down and was found much sooner than the one at Roswell. So I think we could safely say there were two craft.
Two craft. Now, did it appear that these craft, these two unidentified craft or unconventional craft, hit each other and went down? Did it appear that way?
Well, we have no way of knowing from the wreckage we found. We got maybe enough wreckage to fill the bottom of a wheelbarrow.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who's near their computers, can I mention my website?
Please.
Yeah, my website where you can also get the book is called UFOCrashBook.com. Just like for UFO Crash and a book, all one word, www.UFOCrashBook.com. And they can see what we're talking about here. We're talking about some of the wreckage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all right on the homepage.
Okay. Okay. So were you able to speak with any of the first hand witnesses to the crash site?
One.
One.
Yes. It was a 5-year-old boy. He was there with his family.
Okay.
And we talk about him in the book. So as far as we know, it's the only witness to a UFO crash that's still living.
Okay. How old was he at the time?
He was five going on six.
Okay, so what did... Well, does that make him a reliable witness?
Well, I said the only one. I didn't say reliable. What could we all remember, you know, at age five?
Well, I'll tell you what.
I remember a bunch of flowers and so forth and so forth and a long box in the living room. It turned out to be my grandfather's funeral.
Oh, my goodness.
And but I didn't understand what was going on. I think I was about five at the time. And I would imagine, though, if we're looking here at extraterrestrial craft and bodies, there were some family members with him. He had an older brother and a cousin. And so they would be talking about it for years, and mm-hmm. he would pick up a lot of information from them, like most children do. And I assume it would be reasonably accurate.
And what did this 5-year-old that is now a man have to say that was witnessed? Either he witnessed or his family members witnessed?
They were looking for some rocks in an arroyo area. An arroyo in New Mexico is essentially a gulch, a wide gulch that's where stormwater runs off.
Hmm.
And in the plains area. And they came upon this silvery object that was embedded in kind of an embankment. It was about 25 feet across and probably 8 or 9 feet thick in the middle a round shape. And his dad had some training as a tool and die maker and also some military training. And he and his brother, the little boy's uncle, went over to look at it. And when they went over there, they found another man who was nearby, who was the main guy that described the craft. He was a civilian conservation worker named Barney Barnett, and he had discovered it half hour earlier and was over there looking around when the Andersons family came up. Mm-hmm. So they both pretty well described the same thing, but Barnett didn't go public with it. He was with a very sensitive sensitive job with the Soil Conservation Service, and the military was giving a whole lot of farmers trouble taking land over for the White Sands Missile Range, 2 miles to the east.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they decided to cooperate with the military. So he didn't really speak out. He told relatives about it, who eventually got to Stanton Friedman, who was giving a talk in Canada, 1978 or so, and that's how we learned about it.
Okay. Now, they went out at the Roswell site and picked up, you know, the military, you know, they cordoned off the area, and they just made a big line of airmen and went out there and policed the debris, picked it up. And to this day, they're unable to find much of anything, if anything, at the Roswell site. How is it that, didn't they do the same at St. Augustine?
It's different terrain, Dave.
Okay.
We're looking here at sagebrush, hillside, flat area, then sagebrush. We're looking at also a few rattlesnakes. You don't crawl around out there too much when you have that kind of terrain. So the craft came in and took a swath of the sagebrush out, about 100 feet long and about 30 feet wide. We've determined that's how we the rancher who bought the property in the 1980s said that he'd been told something had crashed out there. But he gave us a map and told us how to get there.
Okay.
But it was a entirely different terrain. And we had a sandy arroyo, which was essentially sandy loam soil. And as the craft came in, it hit twice, we think, and it buried material that you wouldn't find laying on the surface.
Mm.
Some of the material was down at 8 or 10 inches. Some of it was on the surface at another spot in the arroyo where it apparently hit first. So we think an inexperienced military unit, of course, they wouldn't have been trained well in early July 1947. I don't think they really got with the training until the Roswell thing hit about a week later. But we think an inexperienced unit got in there and tried to cover things up, and they borrowed a county road grader, I think, and tried to run over the whole site. There's lots, thousands of little pieces of foil and so forth that were laying around. And they just tried to cover it up. But they didn't know there's 14 inches of rainfall every year.
Mm-hmm.
In about 3 years, I think it was uncovered.
Oh.
Stuff that wasn't too deep.
Mm. Yeah, you mentioned the foil now. There, the Roswell crash site, they found a kind of indestructible foil material that resembled balsa wood and small I-beams. Was any of that found at the St. Augustine?
Actually, we found some similar material. I'm looking here at the book, and we found an I-beam that was 13 inches long and 2 inches across, obviously a structural piece, and very, very tough material. And we found with what we think is some of the same material that Jesse Marcel found.
Okay.
Indestructible exterior material.
Mm.
And then we also found some material called a honeycomb that went between the outer layer and an inner layer, and we think was backed by a grid of I-beams inside the craft.
Hmm. You mentioned, unfortunately, I have to say, the late Jesse Marcel Jr. Had you showed this material to Jesse Marcel Jr.?
Didn't have a chance to show it. We kept it pretty well under wraps for about 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
While we were finding it, and then we were also having it analyzed.
Yeah.
And one reason we got the, such good analysis is we didn't tell anyone who was working on UFO material.
Yeah.
As commercial labs that do one of the great work would generally have kicked it back if they'd known it. Oh, but we just paid our money and sent our material in, and they sent back what they had. The readers interested in the science of this project, on the web page, there's a button, a blue button called Metal Scientific Analysis Coburn. And if you press that button, it'll take you to a 42-page report in color. You can download if you want to.
Hmm.
We don't want to hold anything back on this.
Okay.
So our science is right out there for everybody to look at.
Well, I don't want to go into the full 42 pages here, but what basically did the laboratory analysis reveal?
It revealed that every piece of metal we had found there had a coating, a sophisticated coating on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were up to 25 or 30 different elements on each coating, and they were all different. Now, we think maybe only a dozen or 15 were actually put in the metal coating, and the others were probably trace elements of some of the stuff they were using. So the foil wasn't a structural thing. It was something interior. We haven't the slightest idea what it was for.
Hmm.
But we found, a couple square feet of it. And every time we pick up a piece of it, it was different than the one before.
Really? And they weren't able to say, this is off an airplane, a helicopter, this belonged to the Air Force, whatever?
The people that did the analysis were only looking at foil.
Oh.
Later on, we had some people try to get involved. We call them wannabes, people who want to be involved with something that they really weren't. And, this came from an airplane. Oh, well, I know this came from a barbecue or whatever. One guy even came out from Annapolis and announced we'd found a plane wreck. We knew about the plane wreck because it happened in 1944, about 5 miles away. But it was on a highway. A plane was running out of gas, training and during World War II, and decided to put that on a highway. Well, it was a gravel road in those days, and there was hardly any traffic at all. And he managed to do a ground loop and crash. And that was the only crash we know of in the area. We've worked several crashes in the book, four or five of them within 50-mile radius of there. But as far as we know, there were no airplanes or anything that came down in this arroyo area that we worked.
Okay. But as far as the lab is concerned, they weren't able to identify it as... say, from an airplane or what have you.
Well, the lab only told us what was in the metal. That's all we asked them to do.
Okay.
And we surmised then that when we got the lab reports back that a certain metal had been in a certain place in the craft, and the bottom of it had been scraped off, apparently, and that's three layers there. That's an exterior and a piece of honeycomb, which is like a wasp nest that went all the way across the bottom of the craft, something to do with propulsion. Then there was an inner piece, and then that was backed by I-beams. It was quite well made. But we found these pieces and put them back together, and it seemed like that we had pretty well put together the exterior layer of the craft. But we found out later that the craft had been in difficulty miles and miles away and may have gone hitting the mountaintop, and it's possible it hit the Roswell
craft.
UFO.
Yeah.
And limp down to where it came into the plane in St. Augustine.
Okay.
It would show up as very flat on a radar screen.
Right. Okay. I need to take just one moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves out of Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Art Campbell, the author of the book Finding the UFO Crash at St. Augustine, relating to the Roswell, New Mexico crash, but not the Roswell, New Mexico crash. So we were talking, Art, about about this honeycomb. Describe again this honeycomb thing. Weren't they able to, the labs able to say what this honeycomb thing was?
They didn't. We sent me pieces of metal to them.
Uh-huh.
And we took the honeycomb apart and set metal in.
Oh.
We didn't set it in as a honeycomb.
Oh.
We separated the pieces. They were kind of like crepe paper, actually, the same thickness. And so we asked them what it was, and they came back and told us what it was, what the metal was.
What was the metal?
I have it just here. I got the book right in front of me, and I'll just... there were several main metals, and several main metals on the honeycomb, and they were aluminum was the primary metal. Everything in the craft was aluminum with a lot of materials added.
Huh.
And then we had chromium and iron. Those are the four high ones on the major metals.
Huh.
There were about 15 other different metals that were probably trace elements, but we generally only counted the parts per million. Anything over 100 parts per million we thought was significant, and anything below that we thought might be a trace element of some other metal they put in there. So the metals they put in weren't pure, but these were the main ones. And it didn't correspond to any known alloy that we had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
1947.
Okay, now, reason I'm asking is because some of the Roswell debris was analyzed and found to be comprised of very, very terrestrial elements. However, some of the elements were determined by metallurgists to be impossible to combine to make an alloy. And yet, there it was. Was this same true in your findings?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Everything that we found... you could find on Earth,
right?
And there are 115, I believe, elements in the periodic table,
mm-hmm.
114, and they apparently have exactly the same materials on their on other planets that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the way how they put them together, and that particular piece that we were talking about, the exterior piece.
Right.
Is probably the key one, and I can. We called it W101, and it had aluminum, manganese, copper, and zinc, and it was so hard that if we were going to cut a piece off to send to the laboratory, and we had several pieces cut off, we had to go through about 5 Dremel. Little Dremel grinding wheels to get one piece off.
Really?
It was hard. And we show in the book pictures of us, of the gentleman cutting materials off, and it can be seen on that website we talked about, www.ufocrashbook.com. You can see right there on the left-hand margin where they're cutting a piece of metal.
Did you try using a diamond wheel?
Well, we didn't have a diamond wheel.
Well,
and,
not diamond.
I suppose
diamond.
That if somebody, we had to go with what you can find at the hardware store and keep this thing quiet. So I suppose they would have something better in the industry.
Yeah.
But they did a funny thing when they took it to the laboratory.
Okay.
They actually got it pulverized. This is everything we sent to them. It was pulverized, put in a powder form,
yeah,
and mixed with a medium and sprayed into a chamber, 26,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And out the other end came a graph of exactly what metal was in it and how much, parts per million. Fantastic machine. It's called the ICP-MS, and I'm not going to go into the details of it, but you can look it up in at Google, ICP hyphen MS. It tells you about the machine and even shows a demo of how it works.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't developed until 1989.
Okay. So what gets me is this, the The alloys that, you know, if the Big Bang Theory is correct, which I believe it is, and all these planets and solar systems and galaxies came out of the same explosion, okay, that we're all going to have the same material on each and every planet. So it's not too surprising that some other planet or some other civilization elsewhere in the galaxy has the same material. But if we do not know how to take these different elements and mix them together, I mean, I forget which elements they are, but if they're oil and water to each other, they won't mix. And that, and then you find a piece of metal where that alloy has been combined. How do you explain it?
Going back to your Big Bang theory, I think it's a general theory that's assumed.
Uh-huh.
But different planets were made from the Big Bang theory, and it didn't all the planets weren't made at once.
Okay.
And some were developed. I think Earth is something like 3.5 billion years. And they think the Big Bang thing may have happened 8 or 9 billion years ago.
Right.
So each planet is going to have then a certain isotope in their aluminum, a certain isotope in their iron, a certain isotope in their manganese. And that's how we determined what meteors we get that come to Earth. We can analyze them and determine what celestial body they came from in our solar system.
Okay.
They were all created at a different time.
Okay.
And that's why we put that title in the book, Isotopic Analysis, Not of This Earth.
Mm.
And that's what we mean there. We analyze the isotopes. Once we know what was in the metal, we analyze the isotopes and find out it's nothing we know anything about.
Okay. All right. Gotcha now. But, of course, you know, this wasn't a meteor. This was an alloy, a metal.
That's how we know what metals come from Mars, for instance, or what metals might come from Venus or the asteroid belt.
When you say metals...
They'll have a certain signature, isotope signature.
When you say metals, you're referring to the elements within the meteor, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah, we got meteors down. We've been coming into Earth as long as we've had Earth been here.
Right, right.
And so we've pretty well know nowadays what where the meteor came from,
right,
by analyzing the metals in it,
right,
the isotopes.
Very good. So you also found sticks in the shape of a cross. Did you dig under that?
We did.
What'd you find?
First excavation.
What'd you find?
Well, that's also in the book. We found first of all, the cross was wired together, and we found it had a notch in it, which meant that there was meant to be a cross.
So it was man-made?
It was man-made, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And put together with baling wire. And it had lain in that one spot, in that little area in the, where the sagebrush was missing,
mm-hmm.
about 25 or 30 years, because there was lichen on top of the cross, the little growth of lichen.
Okay.
And it indicated to us that it was about been there about 25 years. Picking up the cross, there was no lichen on the bottom, which tells us then that the cross had not been disturbed for 25 or so years. And underneath there, we found some terrestrial material except for a piece of foil. And I'm looking at a picture of it now. It's on my page 15 of my book. And I found a very nice bone. I thought, oh, boy, here we go, his bone. It sawed off at one end, and I was really excited about that. Well, it turned out to be a deer femur. Somebody had poached a deer and cut the bones in the trash area. And then we found some plastic, looks like a little rain jacket, and some plastic buttons that were on a metal circles that buttoned it together. And this is all stuff, terrestrial stuff. It's nothing extraterrestrial.
Okay.
Then we found a battery core, they used to be didn't have metal on the outside of batteries. They were cardboard.
Mm.
And we found the core of a battery, And then it found something. It took us all about 5 years to figure out what it was. It turned out to be a piece of aluminum off a hair curler that the ladies used. They used the well, there's no electricity down there until about 1959. We're talking pretty primitive in those days.
Yeah.
And they put the hair curler in a kerosene lamp. That's how they heated it. Then they crimp it on their hair, and they get curled hair out of it.
Huh.
One of those things that they put inside there that got hot, that was melted on the end, was for that hair curler.
Mm.
Then we found a piece of foil. First piece of foil was underneath there. And some charcoal, another little thing that had been might have been a small wax I-beam. And I thought, well, balsa wood I-beam wax about the same weight. But we only had the T part and one side of it. And it's very similar to what I think Marcel described, that size.
Okay.
There's no strength in a wax I-beam.
Mm.
We did have the wax analyzed. It was carnauba wax. It was a vegetable wax that we have here on our planet. But we have the slightest idea of what it was. And as a Western historian, I spend a lot of time around looking at where buildings were. And you tell when a building was there and how long it was there by the trash that you usually find in the nearest gully.
Mm.
And I was familiar with what you'd find and what you wouldn't find.
Yeah. So you found a lot of over the years. How many years did you excavate on that?
Well, I started excavating in 1997. We finished in 2012.
Oh, boy.
And not every year we'd excavate. Sometimes we'd go down and talk to people. Sometimes it'd be raining. We couldn't get out to the site, you know.
Right.
So we did six or seven trips down there from Oregon, 2,600 miles a round trip, each trip.
Wow.
And we were pretty committed to the site once we found some interesting material there. The first thing we found was we still have the slightest idea of what it was.
Mm.
And it's a picture of it on the website, the homepage. And it's kind of a cream-colored material. And we found out it was made of high-density polyethylene, which is similar to Tupperware.
Huh.
But we didn't have that in 1947. Tupperware wasn't a product till about 10 years later.
Could have been something else. I mean, something earthly.
Well, it's nothing recognizable.
Yeah.
A lot of medical people have thought it was a medical device of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And a bag that had collapsed was the best description I got of it.
Okay.
And I had a number of people look at it, and we were able to get inside and found out that inside the thing was some starch, and inside, according to the starch lining of a thing, was some gold wire. A little tiny piece of gold wire, about 7 microns wide and less than a centimeter long, and some blue fiber, and some also found some copper wire in there that's smaller than anything we have.
Okay, so
it's definitely a foreign object, but we have the slightest idea of what it is, and it's pictured there in the book. A whole chapter's been on it.
So, what kind of activity would have been going on out there in the late 40s? Human activity, other than, maybe people cleaning up a crash of some kind. What kind of...
Well,
Boy Scouts or troops or what?
There were people... Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
I say Boy Scout troops or what?
No, we're not dealing with any groups of people speak of. Their settlement was a few miles away, and it was only about 40 people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were mostly Hispanic people living there, and we'd call them today undocumented.
Okay.
Who were working for ranchers during the roundup at times. Well, the only activity in the hills around there was cattle.
Okay.
And there weren't a lot of people riding like cowboys looking for cows. They knew when you were coming in, they'd hear you drive down the gate, and even in those days, they'd know you were bringing in some food or something if it was food was hard to find. So they'd kind of come to you if you came in, because they knew they'd get good feed that way.
Yeah.
But the rancher that we dealt with, that leased over 100,000 acres, and he ran, several hundred head of cattle. They moved them around so they wouldn't eat too much grass in one place, you see.
All right.
And so then there's a lot of people nearby had trash, and they didn't have trash pickup. It's 40 or 50 people out in the middle of nowhere. They had to get rid of their own stuff, so they threw it in the arroyo, which went, by the way, through the town.
Hmm.
And after the first flash flood, it was gone.
Hmm.
Where it went was down there where we were working, so it pretty well ruled out the idea of using a metal detector.
Yeah.
Human trash around. So we were able to sort it out. We knew what it was.
Yeah. So in other words, there was a lot of human remnants of human activity there.
Well,
along with
the metallic stuff, yeah. There was hundreds of cans of pet milk. Borden also made one, and a little slit in one side, you know, like used for coffee.
Yeah.
And we found out that they were using it for baby formula.
Oh.
And that's how we saw so many cans. We spent a lot of coffee and tea drinkers around here. And I finally found out, some lady said, well, we used to put it in the baby's milk and wean them on it. And a lot of the girls down there who were having children then to childbearing age would rather do that than nurse. So
yeah.
they would get the canned milk and put a little hole in each side, and it would be good for 2 weeks on a shelf even without refrigeration.
So in other words, finding metal with extraterrestrial isotopes in it was pretty much like finding a needle in a haystack out there, isn't it?
Well, it was a surprise. I'll say that for you. Everything we came back from the lab was a surprise.
Yeah.
Nothing we could find. Nothing that was made on Earth.
Really?
We didn't send the earthly stuff in, of course. But
so you were able to recognize this is just a pet milk can. This is just a human hair roller or whatever, but what you did find and send in for analysis, you could not identify as something earthly.
It was absolutely not. We didn't. It's very expensive to run that ICP-MS process. Every time they turn on the machine, it's $500.
Oh, nice.
So we had to be careful what we sent in.
Oh, yeah.
But you had asked about mixing the metals. I think probably it wasn't so much the mixture of metals, but how they tempered it.
Okay.
That made the metal so hard on the outside.
Okay.
It could have been tempered for years. It could have been done. Who knows how it was tempered? But
well,
we don't have anything that hard.
Yeah, you can temper metal. I mean, I used to be a die maker, so I learned a little bit about metals.
Yes.
You can temper metal at different densities. However, if this metal and that metal cannot be mixed to make an alloy, then it can't be mixed. And yet you found evidence of that, right?
Well, if you go to that report, that report that is free, the first six metals we had, five of them were foil, and one was a heavier piece we think came from the top of the craft. It was an exterior piece.
Hmm.
They call it W1 to W6. And they're in that free area called Metals Analysis Colburn, C-O-L-B-E-R-N. He was our chief scientist. He used to also work for Dr. Lear when he was alive. He was his scientist for those implants and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
And he worked in a lab down in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
So he headed up the entire investigation on all our material. And he did a very fine piece of work in that report, and it's there for free. Anybody wants to look at it or download it.
Yeah, I remember Dr. Roger Lear. He was on the show quite a while back, and they found these implants that they could not identify the metal. Plus, they would while in the body, they would send out radio waves.
I know. It was a strange one. What were the homing signals to find the person again? Or how would you, get a signal from the inside of a human body? And I understand there are probably millions of them.
Yeah, yeah. They were
so,
oscillating.
It was one of the strange chapters in UFOs, that's for sure.
I'll tell you what. I'm going to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, Making Waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Art Campbell, the man who spent about 15 years digging up debris from an alleged crash north or west of Roswell in St. Augustine, and the author of the book Finding the UFO Crash at St. Augustine, Isotopic Metal Analysis Not of This Earth. Say that three times real fast.
Yeah, you get the order off the website right through Google. Right. Just click here kind of thing, or you can look it up yourself. Mm-hmm. In your computer, and you can it'll run you right to where you can get it.
Right.
We're getting some really good comments from readers. All of them are 5-star.
Yeah,
so
good.
We're very happy with how it's been received.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Are you familiar with any other UFO crashes, and were similar materials ever found at other alleged UFO crash sites?
As far as we know, Dave, we have the most material ever found by a group of civilians.
Mm-hmm.
That's ever been has been analyzed and published.
Mm-hmm.
And the military really did a fine tooth combing of all the sites, I think, at Roswell and afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow they botched up this one, and the group came in there, and probably some if I see some majors, they get rid of all this stuff, I'll come back tomorrow, I want to see it. Well, they start burying it, you know.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't pick it all up, apparently. It was like tinfoil all over the ground, like, you know, explosion. One guy said like an explosion in an aluminum factory. That was a young boy that was there.
Are we talking about Roswell crash?
No, I'm talking about the our crash.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, Roswell had a lot of material laying, and 3/4 mile long and 1/4 mile wide swath called the debris field.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the sheep rancher, Mac Brazel, found and took into Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Major Marcel from the Army Air Base got out there, the 509th.
Mm-hmm.
And then they really realized what they had, probably on the way home. It was had to keep it quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I think they gave Blanchard and General Ramey said keep it any way you can keep it quiet. So they said, well, it was a weather balloon.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And that pretty well ended this. Into that for about 20 years.
Yeah. And then Stanton Friedman started making waves, didn't he?
Well, actually, Friedman endorses our book. He said that I have both Friedman and Tim Good as people who are endorsing my book.
Good.
And Friedman is the one who gave me the name of the rancher.
Okay.
And so he's been involved with this from the beginning. He hasn't been out there with us, but he was out there in 1990 with the young boy that was then in his 70s, or 65 or so,
mm-hmm.
and with several other people, and they're featured in one of the chapters in the book that show them standing, and the boy
is
now 65, pointing in this direction where we found most of the material.
Okay.
Four men standing, and I think it's chapter 5. Then this guy's pointing. He was the gentleman that found the material.
Okay.
So I must say that there's a lot of controversy in UFO among UFO people about this boy, this site, because he was telling people that Roswell wasn't the only place.
Right.
And he didn't fare too well among the UFO people who were trying to look into what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He had to finally got disgusted and dropped out.
One
time he was interviewed even on Japanese television.
Mm. Well, no, there's certainly, you know, Roswell was not the only UFO crash.
Well, there was a lot of them, but there was one guy that got some small scraps of material over on at the debris field, and guess what it was? It was foil.
Mm-hmm.
He found also buttons, fatigue buttons that you would have if you had guys crawling around, and popping a few buttons and so forth. So I think they were aluminum. But he did find five or six pieces of foil, maybe half a dozen or so pieces, the size of a fingernail.
Size of a fingernail.
Yeah, that's as small as he could find in the Roswell. The debris field.
Okay.
He worked it about, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, you know, they're picking up the big stuff, and if they find a piece of foil size of a fingernail, they may not find it, number one, and if they do, they're going to say, I'm not picking that up. I picked up the big stuff. But
my guess is that it was covered over.
Yeah. Yeah,
and became with the weather and wind and water and everything in those days. Those are early days ago, 14, 15 inches of rain in that part of the country.
Right,
it would expose itself.
Right, but I guess
now our pieces were buried some of them six inches, a foot or so underground. And apparently the military didn't use metal detectors to try to locate buried material. They only were concerned about what was on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's what I'm saying. But even the smallest piece, today, at least today, you're able to magnify it. You're able to, like you say, pulverize it, burn it up, see what it's made out of.
Yeah, and so he had that done, and it was identical to our foil.
Yeah.
They're all different, of course. Why? They're all different. Like shingles, Dave. And they were like old-fashioned wooden shingles, about 4 or 5 inches wide and maybe 12 inches long. And that was the size of the thing must have been a wallpaper or something inside. I have a slight idea what they were used for.
This foil?
It must have meant something.
This foil you're talking about, was that big?
Yes, originally. We found some at our site that had been picked up, folded, and stuck back in the ground.
Really?
One of them looked like four tacos put together. And we talk about it on one of the chapters showing how it came out of the ground, and some of it had a manufactured edge.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't ragged. It was, you can see the manufactured edge, and it was just about folded over about 2 microns thick. Mm-hmm. And we show one edge of that foil. And we think our site was monitored for maybe 15 years or so. People would go out there and keep picking stuff up because the rain and wind would wash it all out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And occasionally some flash flood would come down the arroyo, and anything that was buried in that arroyo area would be exposed. Yeah. So we think people were coming and going there for 10 or 15 years after the crash.
Wow. Still looking for stuff.
And they found it because we found where they picked it up and folded it and put it back in the ground.
Why would they do that?
I don't know. I think they probably got tired of it. Maybe they had their pockets full of something, or they were too lazy. I think getting it out of sight was the priority.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know who they were or what. We did find that we think they had something to do with the cross we've talked about.
But this foil that you're talking about, that was some of the stuff that proved to be had isotopes that were not of this earth, correct?
All the metal.
All the metal.
Heavy metal, all the metal we found. So very heavy, the I-beam, exterior piece, interior pieces. Tends to be found about 5 or 6 pieces of metal that were heavy in addition to the foil. All of it had isotopes that were not recognizable by Earth science.
So when these laboratories that analyzed it gave you the analysis, did they say anything like, where the heck did you get this stuff? It's not of this earth?
No, Mr. Coburn dealt with the laboratory. He was a laboratory man himself. He was working in a laboratory. But he didn't have any of the material done in his laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
He sent it out to the outfit was called Bodie Coat. They were down in the L.A. area to have them do it. Well, he'd bail it from his own laboratory. So they were getting material. from laboratories all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just mixed it in with everything else they had. People were sending all kinds of stuff to them. And they weren't concerned about whether it was... there's about 6,000 patents on aluminum products,
mm-hmm.
by the Aluminum Association. And and you couldn't very well check them out.
No.
And this would include cast aluminum, aluminum foil, of any number of types of motorcycle pieces, anything.
Right.
And so they're in the business of analyzing what's in it and sending the material back.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a clean bit of science. And then Mr. Coburn would then take one that had stable isotopes. Apparently some of them were unstable.
Mm-hmm.
And look at them and see if they compare to the isotopes of the same material on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one of the looking for the chapter here about that. Here it is here now. He only did one of them. He found that antimony was one of the one of the metals, copper and nickel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking at my page 22, and a terrestrial isotope abundance for antimony, the metal, the antimony was 57% here. The sample from that came in our site was 49%. Very significant difference.
Mm-hmm.
And a copper, for instance. Our copper has an isotopic ratio of 69%, which makes it more pure.
Mm-hmm.
And the copper that came in was 48%.
I see.
Found in the Royal. So,
so what would you?
Some of our metals are a little more pure than they have in other places.
So what would you say is the, if anything, was the smoking gun evidence of the crash of an extraterrestrial craft at this St. Augustine site?
Well,
the one thing that stands out.
We've been working on this so long that we kind of forget how it was in the early days. But the only we have some difficulty with some of the people in the UFO community accepting it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's natural. They've put their they've all gone to Roswell and gone to some of the conferences and places, and so we invite skepticism. And people who have read our book are like it.
Well,
and
it's, you know,
and we got some really nice reader comments on the Amazon Creative Space that has published it.
It doesn't matter.
We did our best, and I don't know that the UFO community is ever going to accept it in total.
Well,
they're too diverse to all agree on one thing.
Yeah, but
so,
the thing is, Stanton Friedman endorses it, and Stanton Friedman is well renowned. He investigated the Roswell crash, then he investigated the what he calls a crash at Corona. You know, so there's more than one crash of UFOs. So why wouldn't the UFO community at least investigate your findings?
Well, we've got all the evidence, mm-hmm. and we've picked it up. So we're not announcing where it is, about the first thing.
Uh-huh.
And we don't want people going out there and picking up stuff that we may have missed. And mm-hmm. so we kind of keep it quiet where it is.
Right.
That's just fine with the landowner. He doesn't want people out there wandering around that he doesn't know.
Right.
So it works out really well. Here's what Stanton Friedman said about the book. Excuse me for complimenting myself, but this is what he said. Art Campbell has done an incredible job of researching the recovery of a 1947 crash flying saucer on the plain of San Augustine in the Roswell timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what Friedman said.
Oh, very good. And you.
And then Timothy Good, another well-known author, said, he's a United Kingdom author, After an initial review, it seems superbly researched and includes a lot of important new material.
Hmm.
And we're gonna sit with that. That's good enough for us.
Really?
The best people in the field like what they found and what we've done, and we can't please everybody.
And do you plan on making any further investigations at the St. Augustine site?
Oh, I'm 82 now, and I'm not up to a 2,600-mile trip, even if I fly. I still got to go down and rent a car. It's so expensive. So.
And you don't want to get...
Nothing is planned in the immediate future, no.
Yeah. You don't want to get down on your hands and knees and dig around anymore, huh?
Well, listen, I got to stop getting on my hands and knees when I had my knee surgery in 92, so I can squat, but I can't. I can crawl, but I can't get on my hands and knees.
You can go out there and supervise and point.
Well, I've done some of that, too.
Yeah, you can say to the youngsters, go over there, dig over here, you know?
Well, we found an area that didn't have any human trash in it, and we found most of our good stuff there.
Really?
So it was a little higher.
Mm-hmm.
Higher than Royal, than the stuff that had washed down. So, we're going to hold what we have, and I don't think we could improve it if we wanted to. You always got something when you have a book. You have something you wish you put in and something you had taken out. But we're pretty well done with that process after 6 revisions.
Right, and after 6 revisions. Wow.
Well, we got it the first book out in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And then we didn't start finding the big stuff till 2011.
Right.
And we got the analysis done in 2010 that we mentioned in the Coburn report.
Right.
On the webpage there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what really started us off, was we got the analysis of the foil back and one heavy piece and realized it wasn't from here.
So. Okay, so once again, where can our listeners go to find out more about your work?
Well, go to the website is the best place. That's www.ufocrashbook.com. And there are 5 or 6 categories there that they can choose from. One of them is how to order the book. And the other one deals with the biographical material myself.
Mm-hmm.
Even have an article there that we did for Fire's Files a while back on Eisenhower and possible connection he made with extraterrestrials in 1955.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's on the website.
Mm-hmm.
And the easiest way to get the book is through the website, ufocrashbook.com.
There's still a lot of information from the book on the website. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm surprised at the number of stuff. The pages I get on Google, I get these things. Well, we all the time from somewhere in India or somewhere. Would you like to improve your website? Well, I got so much people now. I don't know what to do with them. They're not all buying books.
No,
but I've got more exposure than I ever dreamed possible.
Yeah.
Because I've got after been in this almost 50 years, I had my finger in a lot of stuff even early on with Kehoe. I was doing some research with. George Adamski, one of the early UFO people, and then I also talked to Harry Truman.
Did you?
Tried to. tried to. He was in his library one day, and I was walked in, and he came in while I was looking at a piece of sculpture, and this is right after the library opened, about 1956.
Mm. Yeah.
And he walked over. He loved to talk to people in his library, so he walked over, took out his hand, and I got mine. We had some family connection. He wasn't a relative, but he knew some relatives that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned them. I said, by the way, do you know Donald Kehoe? And he said, well, no, I haven't had the privilege. And he's an extremely nice man to talk to.
Yeah.
And what line of work is he in? I said, well, he's a retired major in study of flying saucers. Well, Mr. Campbell, I've got some work to do over here in the office.
There you go.
And his departure was not there as cordial as his greeting.
Art Campbell, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and hope we can do this again sometime. Thanks a lot. Bye. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website, and click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, UFOImplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky. The following
space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the functified star.
Stardate. It is Tuesday, November the 4th, 2014. That means it is election day in the state of Michigan. Your DJ Commander Mark Anthony checking in for the funkiest show on your radio. It's called The Planet Funk. And we bring it to you every Tuesday from 2 to 4 on 89.3 WHFR.FM. Dearborn. The only station making waves. You know, the polls will be open until 8 o'clock tonight, so if you're in line before 8 o'clock, you can still get your vote in, so make sure you go out and vote. Today is election day. WHFR.FM. Up next, The Planet Funk.